Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt cordially invites you to take tea with her again today in the Colonial Room of the Park Sheraton Hotel in New York City for a discussion of human rights and the United Nations. Mrs. Roosevelt, as chairman of the Human Rights Commission, has invited three officers of the commission to join her today in discussion. Monsieur René Cassin, representing France, second vice chairman of the Human Rights Commission, Dr. P.C. Chang, representing China, first vice chairman, Dr. Charles Malik, who speaks for Lebanon and is the rapporteur of the commission. Also, Mrs. Roosevelt has invited representatives of two non-governmental organizations accredited to the UN, Dr. Maurice Perlswag, consultant to the United Nations Economic and Social Council from the World Jewish Congress, and Mrs. Eunice H. Carter, who is a member of the Human Rights Committee of the American Association for the United Nations. And now, here is Mrs. Roosevelt.
Good afternoon. I'm so glad to have all of you gentlemen with me today. And we're going to discuss something that is very close to my heart, because I've worked now a long time on the Human Rights Commission, in fact, since the very beginning. And we have drawn up the first part of a Bill of Human Rights, the first part being a declaration which does not oblige countries that accepted it in the General Assembly to change their laws. We're now busy drawing up the first covenant. It's a difficult piece of work because when nations, since it's drawn like a treaty, accept it in the General Assembly, then it must be ratified, as any treaty would be. And then, if their laws do not conform with their undertakings, those laws should be changed. And now, I would like to ask you, Dr. Chang, to tell us a little about the way the Human Rights Commission came into being.
Mrs. Roosevelt, for the last 4 years, the commission has been in existence. The first thing is to bring out the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted and proclaimed by the United Nations a year and a half ago in Paris. And of course, the commission now is engaged in the drafting of the so-called covenant, the first one, as you just mentioned, and there will be more. Covenants, after all, are treaties, while the Universal Declaration was an expression of the common standard for all nations and all peoples to strive after. And it is the hope, I think, of all peoples interested in human rights that whatever we do on the covenant or covenants will not in any sense decrease the value and importance of the Universal Declaration, which is now being taught in all places and in all schools. And I hope that our efforts now in regard to the covenant and covenants will, as a matter of fact, increase the effectiveness of the recognition of the rights and freedoms contained in the Universal Declaration.
Thank you, Dr. Chang. And now, Monsieur Cassin, I wonder if you would tell us what you feel is the most important thing about the covenant.
Je pense que dans le pacte que nous préparons,
in the covenant that we are preparing, there are a number of important things. If I were asked what the most important was, I would say that in the field of international law, we are about to transform and change legislative provisions which up to now pertain to each nation. The most important thing, for instance, is a thing like habeas corpus, protection against arbitrary arrest. The United Kingdom was the first one, centuries ago, to proclaim this principle. Now, we want this particular principle to be a universal one. My country is the country of the Declaration of Human Rights, and we attach particular significance to this covenant and to its being taken seriously. In our recent constitution, adopted in 46, we proclaimed the equality of men and women without distinction of color, religion, or race. Now, we hope that the covenant, which proclaims these same points, will be taken very seriously in all countries. And on numerous points, we are prepared to adjust our own legislation in the hope that other countries will do the same thing wherever it will be necessary, so that the covenant will be something very serious.
I wonder now, Dr. Malik, we all agree, I think, that this is a serious undertaking. And I wonder what to you is the most important thing.
Well, I think really the most important thing about this covenant at the present moment, Ms. Roosevelt, is the fact that there are nations in the world who take this thing so seriously that they are willing to enter into a covenant with one another, binding themselves solemnly in regard to these fundamental human rights. I think that's a great step forward, because it was one thing, you know, to declare these things and to affirm your belief in them, and after all, that affirmation goes as far back as San Francisco, when the non-governmental organizations, with their zeal for this problem, were successful in inducing the representatives in San Francisco to include this matter seven times in the Charter of the United Nations. But now the nations are prepared to go one step further and to say, we are ready to bind ourselves solemnly and to alter our fundamental laws in a way that will protect and promote human rights and fundamental freedoms. This courageous step on the part of the great and small powers is to me one of the most hopeful signs of the present moment.
Thank you, Dr. Malik. But now, you know, there are people who feel that the Declaration was such a broad and good document that possibly having the first covenant not cover all the rights that are in the Declaration may be a disappointment to many peoples in the world. And so today I've brought some representatives, invited them to come here, of the non-governmental organizations so that they can tell us what the people feel about the covenant. And I'm going to ask first Mrs. Eunice Carter to tell us some of the things that she has on her mind. Mrs. Carter.
Well, Mrs. Roosevelt, I have to agree, and our association agrees, with what Dr. Malik just said, that it is a great step forward if we can get a covenant, a treaty, in which nations for the first time bind themselves to respect all fundamental freedoms for all men. Naturally, we'd like to see all of the things in the covenant that are in the Declaration. We'd like to see as solid a covenant as possible, with the social and economic rights covered. But we realize that the important thing is that we get the first covenant with the recognition by treaty of human rights for all mankind. We are concerned more, though, with the implementation, how this treaty is going to be carried out and enforced. We've been a little bit disappointed that the right of petition under the covenant is to be limited to governments.
I know that's been one of the things that has stirred up the non-governmental organizations the most. And I think Dr. Pilsweig feels very strongly about that, so perhaps we let him give his opinion on that point.
Well, Mrs. Roosevelt, it's perfectly true that I feel very strongly about it because, partly because I represent a movement based on respect for the individual. I think in its time, a great libertarian movement, which used to be called the American Jewish Congress, founded by people like the late Mr. Justice Brandeis and Dr. Wise, and a covenant which leaves out the individual as an active force seems to us to be very deficient. Now, I don't want to suggest for a moment that what has been achieved is not of vital and even decisive importance. I think the covenant marks a turning point in the history of mankind, brings the individual, in a certain sense, in direct relationship with the United Nations. But we are very deeply worried about this problem. Supposing a government does not carry out the provisions of the covenant, and such things have been known to happen, what remedy has the individual got? Now, the Anglo-American proposal is that only another government can intervene. Now, there's a possibility that the thing could be worse than that. The Soviet government won't allow anybody to intervene, won't open its books on human rights at all. And I acknowledge that the United States and the United Kingdom have a view which is, from our point of view, a tremendous improvement on that. But we haven't got the faith in governments that some people have on the subject of human rights. The group that I represent, the World Jewish Congress, has got a very long history of ill treatment at the hands of governments, and we think when they do intervene, they're not effective, and we think also that the people whom they intervene to help, they don't always succeed in helping. We'd like to speak for ourselves.
I understand your feeling, of course. But I think I should say, as there's no representative here from the United Kingdom, just one word on the point that we feel is important, namely that this is a beginning, and that the reason we propose to begin by states complaining against states of violations of human rights is because this is new machinery that has never been tried before. And we are not at all sure of how it will work, of what can be done. And therefore, it is very important to us that this machinery should be tried out. I am quite willing to think of this as a progressive, and I'm sure the United Kingdom is willing to think, of the measures of implementation as progressive steps, and I don't wonder at your desire to move faster. On the other hand, I have a feeling that the important thing is that our first covenant should be a covenant that it is very difficult for any government to refuse to ratify. And if that is the case, I'm hoping that the United States will be among the first to ratify, because I feel that as one of the leading democracies, we should be the first to ratify, or among the first. And that, of course, is one of my reasons. I see Dr. Malik just anxiously waiting.
Well,
Go ahead, Dr. Malik.
The question I wanted to put to you about this matter is, supposing we have a covenant which has only a few fundamental rights, which will be ratified by your country or any other country. What would then be your attitude towards the other rights in the declaration? Wouldn't there be a prima facie, I wouldn't say discrimination against these rights, but wouldn't the common man understand you to say that you really care only for these rights that you have ratified, but not for the others that you haven't ratified?
Well, of course, I have never looked upon the Declaration in that light. I've always felt that the Declaration was a broad statement of that set standards and announced principles, but did not actually naturally put things into law. Now, I cannot see that one can do the whole thing at one time, and I've always thought that the Declaration stood. What it was would always stand, a great document of principle, of things that we were striving for the world over, but that as we began to translate that into law, it would require education, it would require greater knowledge throughout the world, and therefore must be done step by step. And I think it's quite natural that we should want the first covenant to be accepted by as many people, as many nations as possible, because you get into the habit of ratification.
Permettez-vous, madame, de rappeler...
May I venture, Mrs. Roosevelt, to remind you that it is the Charter, first of all, which calls for respect of human rights, and the states and peoples must know that it is thanks to the Charter that we can proceed further and deeper. Those who do not sign the covenant are nevertheless held to respect and observe human rights. As far as the covenant itself is concerned, you know that my country, after having had rather broad views, has resigned itself, I may say, to the stages method. But the first stage must be a substantial stage. In a rather considered manner, we have postponed economic and social rights to be included in a special covenant. They deserve a special covenant. We have also postponed the possibility of having individuals have the right of petition because particular problems may arise in that connection. What is important, however, is that the rights that we do recognize in this covenant should be observed, and their observance has to be assured by an absolutely impartial organ. That is why France has proposed that this impartial organ should be elected by the International Court of Justice at The Hague, not in order to make it a substitute tribunal, but in order to inspire particular confidence in the covenant, a confidence which is not so readily given to people appointed by governments. We cannot make a covenant without having the confidence of the peoples of the world.
I know very well, Monsieur Cassin, your feeling that the court at The Hague would have been perhaps a more impartial body. But for us, we felt that the covenanting states, the states that agreed to this, would be bound by their word. And therefore, they were the ones concerned. They were the people who would have named people on a panel. They were the people who would be concerned in every case that came up. And to us, it seemed natural to think that since those people must be people of high standing and experience in human rights, that they perhaps would be even better fitted than the judges of the court. Now, this is experimental machinery. We know we may make mistakes. And that's all that one can say. And Mrs. Carter is most anxious to say something.
Well, I wanted to say that our association agrees with Professor Cassin in this matter. We think that since we have the International Court and the machinery set up, and there seems to be a growing disinclination on the part of nations to use that court, which we think is an impartial tribunal, will inspire that very confidence about which you talk. But if I may say one more word about this matter of petition. Thinking this over and talking with other people, I've had an idea. And I've wondered what you think about this. As you say that this is all in the experimental stage. When the covenant goes to the General Assembly in the fall, Would it be possible, for instance, by resolution of the General Assembly, under that article in the Charter which permits them to study human rights and methods for its implementation, to have then and there set up, for instance, a fact-finding board and invite people, individuals, and perhaps non-governmental organizations to send petitions, complaints of violations of human rights, just a temporary board, maybe 3 years or something of that sort, and at the end, find out what kinds of petitions you'd get, how many you'd get, how many abuses you'd get, and what kind of machinery would have to be set up.
That would simply be setting up the machinery which the Human Rights Commission has turned down. I would think it quite possible to pass a resolution asking the Human Rights Commission to study this question further and to move forward. But I would not think it well to set up the machinery that has not been agreed to by the Human Rights Commission in this session. You would just be going around another way to bypass the Human Rights Commission.
It wasn't my idea that the petition should go all the way through, merely as samplings and studyings.
Oh, that would be very confusing, I think. Dr. Chang, what do you think about
I'm just
that?
Wondering whether we may not, during these very few moments, to go into too many details. Perhaps for the people who have not been in touch with our discussions, they may not be so well informed concerning the technical points that we are dealing with. These technical points are very important, but I think, Madam, you have said the word that is extremely important for the world as a whole, namely the emphasis not only implementation through legal procedure, but implementation through education. I think that should be the constant and the initial effective attack on the whole thing. We are not properly informed yet concerning the real injustices that are going on. And if we should direct the world's attention to details of a technical nature, then we'll lose sight of the big thing. So I think while we should pay attention to these various matters of technical organization, we should also not lose sight of the larger significance. And I hope the commission that has been working for the last 4 years, now drafting the covenant, should at the same time keep the whole world in mind so far as the educational phase of our work is concerned.
What you said about education interests me, because when we passed in the declaration the article which said that we were opposed to slavery and slave trade in all its forms, I thought that addition, which if I remember rightly was a USSR addition, was perfectly foolish, because I was sure that today there was no slave trade. And the other day there walked into me a woman who was a missionary somewhere who came to explain to me what I didn't know at all, that where she knew of certain slave trade.
That's right, sir.
And I couldn't have believed it. So you see, there's always education.
That's
Dr.
Right.
Valley.
Well, now, Mrs. Roosevelt, you always caution us in the commission to go slowly and to be careful, because the great nations have their own problems and they must move according to their own pace. Now, I have the highest respect for the responsibilities of the United States and of France and of the United Kingdom. And certainly, without their leadership in this field, we couldn't move along. But I have the feeling at times that they are moving a bit too slowly, that the present world situation requires, simply requires, they take the lead far more vigorously than they have done so far. Now, I know the difficulties in your system here. I know your constitution. I know the difficulties in your Senate and in your Congress and all that. But it seems to me the world situation, madam, is such that you've got to move faster and you've got to lead the rest of the world in this fundamental field, excuse me for putting it, more than you've been doing so far. Because if you don't lead the rest of the world, there are others who will lead it.
Now, I will say one thing to Dr. Pilswag. He represents a non-governmental organization. I'm sure he will agree with me that in a democracy, leadership has to come from the people. That doesn't mean there cannot be leaders, but it means the leaders must have a very good and solid following. What do you think about our following?
I think that, I think it's been rather underestimated, Mrs. Roosevelt. I think that if this challenge is thrown down in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and in the other countries in which there is democracy, and even in countries in which there is no democracy, the strength of this challenge, and I might say even the splendor of the ideal, will produce an overwhelming rush of support. After all, what you're trying to do is to have a peaceful revolution. If this covenant, even the covenant that I'm not satisfied with, goes through the Senate of the United States, that will be a tremendous achievement. And I just wanted to say this.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
But it's an achievement which I think, if everyone who believes in it is mobilized, is possible to get. And I just want to say that what we're suggesting in the right of petition is not untried. Under the League of Nations, in a certain form, it worked. Under the United Nations, in the trusteeship area, it has worked. I admit we want to go a little further. But I agree with my friend Dr. Malik that we look to the leadership of the spokesman of the great English-speaking nations, among whom the right of petition has been a fundamental right all these years, to lead at this point, and I think the people will follow.
But you have had in your own government, sir, leadership along certain lines, and you haven't been able to get through the things that were advocated. Now, sir, that's the challenge. Now, I know you have something to say.
Madame Roosevelt,
Mrs. Roosevelt, may I suggest that now one cannot reasonably think of an international court of human rights in just those terms, but perhaps between the right of complaint of states and the right of petition of individuals, there may be some intermediary compromise. Perhaps the idea that was launched by the non-governmental organizations, particularly the Advisory Committee of Jewish Organizations, to set up a kind of Attorney General of the United Nations, who might speak in the name of all of the United Nations and who would advise the Committee of Human Rights of violations, perhaps this idea has the greatest future. I, however, wish to state my point of view. What we have to do is adopt progressive measures, measures that countries will be able to ratify, and particularly provisions that can be enforced.
That, of course, is something which gives the progressive idea, sir. And I think for all of us, that's the way we want to go. Now I'd like, first of all, to say that I thank Bren Grauer, because I forgot him at the start. I thank all of you for being with us today. And to you who listen, I would like to say, please think about human rights at home and in the world, and let us know your thoughts.
You have been one of the welcome guests at this, the 14th of Mrs. Roosevelt's Sunday afternoon teas at the Park Sheraton Hotel in New York, listening to a discussion of human rights and the United Nations by Dr. P.C. Chang, representing China, Monsieur René Cassin, representing France, Dr. Charles Malik, who spoke for Lebanon, also Mrs. Eunice H. Carter, who is a member of the Human Rights Committee of the American Association for the United Nations, and Dr. Maurice Perlswag, consultant to the UN Economic and Social Council from the World Jewish Congress. Next week, you're cordially invited to be present when an observance of World Trade Week, which by presidential proclamation begins May 21st, Mrs. Roosevelt's guest will be Senator George W. Malone, Republican from Nevada, William L. Batt, President of SKF Industries, Mr. Philip Reed, President of General Electric, and Mr. O.R. Strachbein, Chairman of the National Labor Management Council of Foreign Trade Policy. The subject of the discussion will be world trade and the United States. This has been an Elliot Roosevelt and Martin Jones production. Today with Mrs. Roosevelt is one of the programs being recorded for use by the Voice of America for its international transmissions. Our subject again for next week, world trade and the United States. Do join us next week.